The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Value is such an important word in life, in investing. We were just talking about your vacation being away, value with family, how you value your father as well, the time that you had. But I think it's important if we're measuring value, we have to measure it in the right increments, don't we?
Yeah, and I think the value of assets has always been key. I mean, if you go back through time, it was about the 1930s that The Intelligent Investor was hatched by Graham and Dodd.
That's the book, The Intelligent Investor.
That's right, and he popularized something that became the backbone of the success of Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway, which is you buy assets when they're cheap, and you wait a long time. And those two things in combination are compelling, but it takes a very unique outlook and perspective to do that. You need to know that you bought them right in the first place in order to sit with the conviction and through long periods of time where day-to-day events may dissuade you from an original decision unless you have solid data and fact to base that information on.
Well, and I think it's important to understand, too, very few young investors understand this concept because part of it just takes experience. You have to see cycle after cycle. And, you know, Dave, I was just shaking my head. I couldn't believe the man who was there at Columbia with Ben Graham back in the 1930s, he's still investing. 108-year-old Irving Kahn.
It's Mark Faber recently quoted this man, Irving Kahn, great money manager. Again, he was the teaching assistant for Ben Graham while he was while Ben Graham was lecturing at Columbia University in New York City.
In the 1930s.
Right, yeah. Right. And his career on Wall Street began in the 1920s. And he said this recently, if the market is overpriced, an investor must be willing to wait. What that's reminding us of is that a value investor, what are they really looking for? They're looking for a dollar selling for 50 cents. It's not $1 selling for $2 with the hopes of it selling for $4. And this is, you know, maybe simple. Maybe this is just, you know, unimportant facts, but his perspective, I think from a 108-year-old man, worth considering. He says that private investors should tune out the prevailing views they hear on the radio, television, and internet. They're not helpful. You must have the discipline and temperament to resist your impulses. Human beings, he says, have precisely the wrong instincts when it comes to markets. If you recognize this, he goes on to say, you can resist the urge to buy into a rally, that is, buy when prices are going up, and sell into a decline when prices are going down. 108, and he's still going to the office 3 times a week. Hats off to you, Mr. Kemp.
Well, and let's just put this in perspective for a second. You know, we had a program a couple of weeks ago where we said we are marking the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. Irving was 8 years old. He can remember the beginning of World War I. He can remember when we were on a gold standard, when we moved off of a gold standard. He can remember the wars, World War I, II. He can remember the market crashes and the market booms. He's managing, what is it, $600 or $700 million right now.
Waiting is something that doesn't come easy to investors. But I think when you've been around a little while, it's really not that big of a deal. You know, I think of the gold market in the last 3 years. It's been an interesting and even grueling wait, but it is still a compelling value and it's still a compelling offer in terms of real money and an insurance in a financial system that has its fleas. You know, I mean, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, stocks are expensive. Gold and silver are cheap. If you watch the nominal values of things, this is a very simple observation.
Let me go ahead and differentiate then nominal value, which is valued in dollars, fiat currency, relative to what you like to talk in, Dave. You like to talk about the real Dow. You like to talk about real estate prices. You like to talk about real money. Now, if you're valuing something in something that the Federal Reserve can just print in unlimited quantities, you're really not getting a good idea. But
and
if you value it in real,
it's not going to come as a surprise to see prices increase. And that was obvious in our conversation last week with Adam Ferguson, where, again, if you print more money and the things that you're buying and on a day-to-day basis are going up in price, the price is not particularly relevant. So you deal with this issue of nominal values all the time, but not thoughtfully enough, I don't think. And this is, again, where if you look at the real Dow, that is the Dow priced in gold, your year 2000, 1999, to present returns are negative 70%.
Even though nominally.
Down 70%.
Even though nominally, you've got actually an
extra 5,000 points added. And that's all well and good. I'm not arguing or contesting the fact that there hasn't been growth in the stock market.
But relative to ounces of gold that would have purchased the Dow back during that time versus now, you're still down 70% if you owned shares.
And I think that trend will continue regardless of nominal pricing. In other words, I think you could see the stock market go up and still, in terms of being priced in ounces, go down, and you could continue to actually lose ground as an investor with that real money position still being of greater value. And I think we'll see the Dow trade in real money terms at an 85 to 90% discount from those 2000 peak values. Now, obviously, peak values, what am I talking about? We're at new peak values if you're talking just nominal figures. But again, when you're pricing things in gold terms, the Dow cost 43 ounces of gold. The cost to buy a share, a cross-section of the 30 greatest companies in the country, 43 ounces would buy it for you. Today, it only costs you 13 and a half ounces.
Yeah, so in 2000, it would have taken 43 ounces of gold to buy a share of the Dow. And at this point, what you're saying is 13 and a half, actually closer to 14 right now, isn't it?
Right, and the cycle that we are in is reminiscent of the cycles we've seen over the last several decades and even several centuries, where you oscillate back and forth in terms of the values between paper assets and tangibles. At the end of a cycle, your target is a 3-to-1 ratio, not the 13.5-to-1 ratio that we have today, but a 3-to-1, even a 2 or 1-to-1 ratio, implying that from this point right now, your increase in purchasing power at a minimum would be 4.5 times to as much as 12 times, depending on where the ratio settles in. And I just would say this, if gold and silver are cheap, then you have these sort of paper proxies for gold, gold shares, that are even cheaper, actually priced today, just gold versus gold shares, at a level we haven't seen since the year 2000, at the very end of a 20-25-year bear market in gold. They are at those same kinds of levels relative to gold as we speak.
So if you're Irving Kahn and you're looking at this and you say, I have 108 years of experience in determining value, you would probably say that gold and gold shares right now really make sense.
Well, and I don't know that he's interested in gold or gold shares, but I think Kahn's grid of value would say this. It's worth asking the question, are you buying a dollar for 50 cents? And if you're paying premiums for the purchase, instead of, you know, $2 for a dollar's worth of assets, then you're on the wrong side of the equation. Ultimately, you will be an economic or financial loser in the game of life. Why? Because in money and investing, value is so very, very important. And so the cost of your original investment is absolutely critical. And I would look and say that coming into the stock market today, you're paying premiums. And what you're seeing is really the premiums that are most comfortably paid when you have a group of investors surrounding you. They're all exercising the same thinking pattern, what some have described, a phenomenon known as groupthink. It seems, you look around you, there's no one contesting the idea that you should be in the stock market. And again, you would have to set aside Kahn's earlier advice of don't listen to the news media. Tune out the prevailing views that they hear, you hear on radio, television, and the internet. Why? Because they're not particularly relevant. It's kind of white noise. And it is interesting to me, this is not very often, if ever, that I've come across a 108-year-old man who's still actively investing on Wall Street. 108-year-old man, period, but one who cut his teeth on Wall Street in the 1920s and 30s, suggesting that if you can't find value, you just have to wait. You have to be willing to wait.
Well, and it's been interesting this last 14, 15 years, just how much money has been printed, especially actually since 2008. You know, we're talking about the pricing of something in real money, which real money is gold, or borrowed money. And I mean, how much has debt increased just in the last few years?
Yeah, well, I mean, you ask government debt. Just looking at the government debt is up 3 times. We started in the year 2000. With $5 trillion in government debt. And that's now close to or above $17 trillion.
So 3 times. I mean, it's a tripling of debt.
Meanwhile, you've got GDP growth that has not expanded over 3 times. Economic activity has not kept pace with the growth that we've seen in debt. And those two things, if they're moving in lockstep, they kind of balance each other out. The economy growing in a parallel track with debt, the economy and its productivity, the income, the resources that are being generated, basically give you the allowance for and the extra revenue to stay on top of that debt, the new debt that you are accruing. But if you don't have enough sufficient growth in the economy, then how is it that you're going to keep up with interest payments?
You have to print money.
Well, and one of the ways that we've kept up with interest payments is that we've seen government step in and manipulate rates to such a low level that we can afford it, and yet we don't see the economic mismatch between growth in debt and non-growth in the economy because of this sort of gerrymandering in the interest rate market. That's a very critical factor. What has happened in the interest rate market is not natural. It's not natural, nor is it long-term sustainable. So, you know, we're leveraging ourselves up on the assumption that the old normal economic variables will appear at any moment. And we aren't bankrupt yet. We are not bankrupt yet because rates have been forced lower. And that has allowed us to shoulder the debt, the new debt accrued, going from 5 to 17 trillion.
Well, and Russell Napier says that that could go on for a while because politically it's suicide if they allow those rates to rise and they get themselves into a situation that they can't pay the interest on that expanded, that tripled debt.
So we could expect for many months, if not years, for the government to attempt to control market price dynamics. And if that's with us for a long time to come, it is because, as Napier has very realistically put into the equation, there are high political costs for real market dynamics being allowed to impact investor balance sheets and for real market dynamics being allowed to impact consumer spending habits. If those things were to occur, what would happen? What would the knock-on effect be? Very unhappy constituency groups, and those constituency groups, then all of a sudden you go back to the old adage that we've heard from other politicians, it's the economy, stupid. They're able to push that off, and politicians are able to, given the monetary policies that we have in place today, skirt those issues.
So as long as they can maintain the faith in the central banks, they can probably maintain this facade.
Well, faith is an interesting thing, because you're really talking about the general public trusting in the magisterial powers of central banks. Now, this is, I think, very important because you could at this point say to yourself, well, right, so they've manipulated the markets. The whole thing is rigged. And so, you know, shouldn't we just play the game? Everyone else is. Never forget the taper tantrum last summer.
Now, that was when Ben Bernanke came out last fall and just mentioned that he might start tapering of the quantitative easing.
And if you allow that experience, what happened in those few months, to be seared into your memory, it serves as a reminder of how fast and how powerful real market forces are in aggregate. Man thinks, and I think just men, women in general, think presumptively that they have power until they encounter a greater force. Yeah, I spent some time on a paddleboard just here recently, and I usually went out very early in the morning because there's no wind. The beauty of being out when there's no wind is that I am more powerful until there's something more powerful than I.
You have control.
And what is that that gets lost when the wind picks up? All control.
You're right.
And so, there is this sense in which here I am just paddling along out into an open bay and everything's fine. And then all of a sudden the wind picks up in the slightest. And here I go from setting a stiff pace to being stopped in my tracks. Why? Because again, we live with the presumption of power until we encounter a greater force.
Well, and it's very humbling, Dave. I grew up flying radio control airplanes with my father. And so my son and I were out back. It was nice the other night, and I had an RC plane, radio control plane. And it was very still near the ground, and I got a little cocky. This is a very lightweight RC plane. Got a little cocky, and I went on up at altitude. And my son said, Dad, there's quite a bit more wind up there. You better be careful. That plane's not that powerful. Well, needless to say, I lost about a $200 airplane. We watched it. There was just no way to cut back through the wind, and I just watched it fade into the sunset. So, it's humbling, but it's more than humbling if you're the Federal Reserve. It's devastating.
Yeah, and I think this is where we're not applying common sense as investors. The investment community as a whole is forgetting some very basic things. And, So an outdoorsman is always aware that control is only for a moment, and it's not something that you're capable of governing. I mean, we go out into the mountains here, and we're at a turning point seasonally. We could get an afternoon rain shower up in the mountains in the high country, and that rain shower, even though it was 85, 90 degrees in the afternoon, you can have the temperature drop 50 degrees in 20 minutes and be in a snowstorm. In a snowstorm, in that short period of time. And again, you have this sense of it's happy-go-lucky, I've prepared. We talked about this the other day when we climbed the 14er with the boys.
Right.
There is this sense in which an outdoorsman needs to be circumspect. Investors, too, need to be circumspect about what they're actually in control of and who they trust or believe has complete control in the marketplace. And I think this is where, again, there is a presumption of power until a greater power or a greater force is discovered. And that to me is the market expressing itself in so many terms, in terms of confidence. Today, the Fed has earned the faith and trust of the marketplace. And that faith and trust, because it's not based on fact, can be shaken, I think, very easily. And just as we saw that taper tantrum last summer, there is power and force in the marketplace, which the Fed cannot stand up against.
Well, and you know, there's a perception, and I have the same perception. If I'm looking at the stock market rising, the perception is, oh, there's more people buying stock. But strangely enough, we've seen the stock prices rising. If, however, you look at what a professional looks at, which is also volume, the volume has been decreasing as the price has been increasing. Now explain that.
Well, a good friend of ours commented recently that late summer rallies on very poor volume that push major stock indices towards or above record levels have a tendency to end poorly in the autumn.
Like 1987, the year 2000.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, you basically hit your peak in late July, back in 87. And you could look at these period specific time frames and the facts that were occurring, the drive of the marketplace, who was involved, who was interested in purchasing equities. And, you know, Wall Street's a ghost town. Right now, Wall Street's a ghost town, and yet we've hit new record highs as we end the summer. Keep that in mind. Late summer rallies on poor volume, which is exactly what we've had, very poor volume, that do push major stock indices towards or above record levels, have a tendency to end poorly in the autumn.
Well, and we're seeing the doctoring of numbers in other areas. I mean, we've talked a million times about, employment and CPI. But, you know, these Fed surveys that come out, that supposedly the Fed survey tells you whether you're increasing or decreasing. You know, they're having some very negative numbers, but they come out with the overall figure and say, hey, this is positive. How does that work? That seems like it's doctoring.
I think you're seeing a trend intensify, which is the usefulness of statistics in marketing to the hoi polloi. If you can convince the vast majority of people that something is true and back it with a number, we live in the age of science where numbers are everything. We could care less about anything unless it can be substantiated with numbers. What people don't understand is that you can substantiate anything with numbers. You can substantiate absolutely anything. So you have the BLS, you have the Fed's inflation statistics, you have GDP, and now you have the Philly Fed survey. From 10 days ago, they had 7 out of 9 measured categories in decline from 1 month to the next. And yet they still managed to post an overall positive figure for this composite. Liars? Yes. Figuring? Yes, no doubt. And this is the reality. It illustrates a conclusion governing the gathering and synthesis of data. And yes, that is putting the cart before the horse, but that's what we're talking about. We're talking about politics reigning supreme and agenda reigning supreme and the hoi polloi just having to go along with it, assuming that the numbers are accurate, because frankly, you don't have a PhD. And so who are you to challenge the veracity of a given number if you don't have as much or better in terms of your educational background than those at the Fed?
Well, Dave, I mean, just that use of authority we've seen back in the old days with cigarette commercials. Okay, you remember the cigarette, and I don't remember the brand, that said, doctors prefer, and then it gave the brand of that cigarette. Okay, now for the person who's looking at a doctor as an authority, they're thinking, doctors prefer. Well, I guess that must be good for me. And yet you've got these the Philadelphia Fed survey, 7 out of 9 measured categories declining, yet they still post an overall positive figure. To me, that's like saying doctors prefer this particular cigarette.
Well, and it leans heavily on the weighting of those composites, the weighting of those contributing figures. But that's the same thing that they've done with inflation. You can flexibly change the weighting for each of those inflation components. When you're measuring inflation and you're trying to get an idea of what is our total inflation problem, well, let's go measure 10 different items to see if inflation is on the increase. If you end up with an inconvenient number, and that would be an increase of inflation in one particular category, then you just lower the weighting of that particular component part to where it doesn't impact the total statistic, that is CPI, or Consumer Price Index, or in the case of the Fed, the PCE, in a way that exaggerates the inflation number. So right. Inflation will always be tame as long as the statisticians are playing with the numbers in a way that's favorable to whoever's calling the policy decision. So, you know, the idea of Fed independence, I mean, look, we're going to end up with more and more positive GDP figures, inflation figures, employment figures. Why? Well, as we march towards the election, and this is November, of course, it's only natural. It's only natural. People in a position of subservience where they are answering to a boss who answers to a boss who answers to a boss who answers to a boss who ultimately answers to the Oval Office, guess what? Pressure is applied at the top, it trickles down, and you don't know why the results that you put in were handed back to you. The math that you did needs to be recalculated, but you can do your job because you don't want to lose your job. That's the world we live in. And then there's the investment community. And the investment community has to live with this balderdash as if it was true. And this is, again, where faith and belief, it's really an interesting phenomenon. It's really an interesting phenomenon. You're right. There is an appeal to authority that we live with and live under in this country, more and more so all the time. Well, you know, there's other issues in play which I think go back to sort of core fundamentals. We talked about government debt accelerating.
Yeah, you said three times. I mean, it's tripling in the last 15 years. And corporations are also going into debt, are they not?
It looks like we'll add to that debt figure at least $500 billion this year. So it's not as bad as years that we've had in past, but it'll still pass the $500 billion mark in new debt for 2014. Corporate bond issuance, you know, what's a $500 million here or there? Well, $500 million here and $500 million there makes $1 trillion, and $1 trillion is this year's issuance for corporate America. Of course, they're doing it at very low rates. Some could argue that this is smart if you're financing a growth plan on very inexpensive long-term rates. But here's the problem, and we certainly have highlighted this in the past, a lot of, not all of it, but a lot of this debt is going to buy stock with the proceeds of the debt issue.
Yeah, you've talked about that before, where the companies are actually borrowing, turning right around and buying their stocks. That increases the profitability per share of every share, right? Because you're taking some off the market. But then you're also seeing the debt increase at extremely low interest rates. I do understand, okay, let's say you're running a corporation that has to run on debt, and you're looking at the Federal Reserve, and they're talking about raising interest rates. Maybe these guys are looking at it and saying, hey, let's go ahead and get these rates while we can.
Well, sure. And I mean, that makes sense. Listen, this week, do you know what closed this week in Spain? 50-year bond offering at 4%. I mean, you know, and if I was the Spanish government and people were foolish enough to give me 4% money for 50 years, looking at my track record of defaults, of inflation, of busting promises from a fiscal level, listen, there's always a patsy, right? And in this case, it's the general public willing to pay hard-earned money up front for a 4% rate of return on a Spanish government bond, locking you into 50 years of interest rate exposure. I'm sorry, that's insane. Now, if you're the Spanish government, it's brilliant. Why? Because you know there's enough patsies out there to get away with it.
And you know you'll never pay it back.
Of course not. No, that's not an issue. This is the beauty of the financial world that we live in, much of which is constructed on a confidence game. And, you know, I don't fault corporate executives, corporate managers for adding $1 trillion in debt. I do fault them for misusing those funds. If you want to grow the business, if you're going to grow the franchise, by all means, increase the revenue of the business. But if all you're doing is targeting a better compensation package for yourself, getting a bonus because you increase earnings per share, and you increase earnings per share by reducing the total of shares outstanding, by taking that $1 trillion and buying back company shares, I think it's disingenuous. I think it is fraudulent. I think it's prosecutable. I think that time and the tide of events will allow some of these things to come out and permanently change Wall Street and the way that companies are managed. But that's the kind of legislation that you can only expect after a major market collapse. Remember Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall came about after the collapse in 29, not before. Things got out of hand. Banks on Wall Street were buttering their own bread. And it was determined that legislation had to be put in place to protect the consumer. And thus Glass-Steagall came into place. Yeah, of course, we had Glass-Steagall thrown out in 1999 because the consumer didn't need protecting. Of course, maybe people were just angling for a larger, more comprehensive piece of legislation. Glass-Steagall wasn't comprehensive enough, so now we have Dodd-Frank. Well, you know, again, I guess what I'm concerned about is $1 trillion in new debt this year for corporations. It's all well and good if the economy recovers and you've got plenty of growth in your company to pay the debt requirements that you've just obligated yourself to. But what happens? What happens when your cash flows diminish? What happens when you've increased your debt payments? This is where leverage is difficult to deal with in the context of recession. Recessions are deadly for the overleveraged company.
Well, Dave, on Saturday mornings, sometimes we'll turn the radio on and listen to the car guys. Okay, they come on from 11 to noon.
Click and clack the Tappet Brothers.
Click and clack the Tappet Brothers. They're hilarious. But they always have a puzzler. Okay, they have a puzzler of the week. And I'm going to tell you this. I am puzzled. And I'm going to throw this out for you. And I want to throw it out for the listeners, too. I am puzzled at why you can get interest rates that are so darned low in France and in Spain and in Portugal. I mean, these are rates that are lower than a U.S. Treasury bond. Now, let me just explain my question for the person who doesn't understand interest rates. The lower the interest rate that's paid on a bond means it's the safer or the more likely bet that it will be completely paid off. Now, let me mention the countries again. Portugal, Spain, France. I mean, the spreads between European nations and the U.S. are widening, and the Europeans are going down as if they're the safer bet. Now, this will be the answer to the puzzle. Tell me why.
Well, there's a couple of things in the mix here. And Mohamed Al-Arian, you know, he used to be at PIMCO. He still advises Allianz and I think is one of the new economic advisors for the White House. He's reflecting on how low the volatility has been in the foreign exchange markets. And he thinks that that's coming to an end in large part because of this distortion in bond spreads. And again, a bond spread is just the difference between one particular interest income stream and another. So let's illustrate that. You know, your Portuguese bonds today are at about 3%. Compare that to U.S. Treasury, which is about 2.4%. So there's 60 basis points spread between the two. The Portuguese have, you know, having more, if you will. They're at 3%. But you know, this is why he's concerned. Spanish bonds at 2.38% are lower than U.S. Treasuries.
That's like saying that Spain has a more likelihood of paying back their bond than U.S.
Right. And again, this goes back to this very, very simple observation we made earlier, which is that we have $17 trillion in debt and an economy which is grinding down, not gearing up. The growth cycle is, it's harder and harder to make money in the economy. We're not seeing a ratcheting up in GDP growth. We're seeing decay, if you will, a flatline, if you will. Meanwhile, growth continues in the debt sector. So this is what's concerning is you've got Spain with no prospects of paying back their debts, and yet their interest rate is lower than ours in the U.S. We're supposed to be the benchmark for risk-free rates. The U.S. Treasury is, quote-unquote, the benchmark for risk-free rates, and yet French 10-year treasuries are selling with a yield of 1.25. So the French displace the U.S. as the benchmark for risk-free rates. How about the Germans? Well, arguably the Germans, to some degree, given their monetary conservatism, you know, they're at 90 basis points for 10 years. So 0.9 of 1%. And the Swiss are at 0.42, less than 0.5% on a 10-year government bond from the Swiss. But again, Portugal, 3. Spain, 2.38. The U.S. 10-year treasury, 2.4, even greater. Well, when Spain, locked between Spain and Portugal, is that, I mean, are we really amongst our peers when we're talking about what just a few months ago were the pigs? Does this in any way strike you as odd? And Al-Arian's comment is, it's not natural. It's not sustainable. This will reverse and you're going to see massive increase in volatility in the Forex markets. That is, your foreign currency markets.
And you cannot have those rates without having someone there to purchase those bonds. And, you know, even commercial purchasers right now are increasing their euro exposure over the United States. I mean, what is that saying?
Well, it's curious. If you think about the more attractive yield on offer in the U.S. 2.4 is better than 1.25 in France. So why are people clamoring for French bonds at a pace that is forcing the price higher and the bond yield lower in France compared to the U.S.? Well, you know, what this suggests to me is that people see a sure bet from the ECB.
They're just going to print it and buy it.
And this is the interesting thing. There's always a workaround. Listen, if you've raised children, you know there's always a workaround. You can tell them what the rules are, and they have nothing better to do with their time. You're trying to make a living. You're trying to bring all the details together of managing a household. And guess what? Your children have nothing better to do than figure out how to game the system, how to figure out what the boundaries are, how to figure out how to press them or work around them or redefine terms towards their favor. Think of this. The ECB cannot buy bonds directly from the government, but the ECB can provide any amount of money they want to banks, and those banks can go buy the bonds, and those banks can register those government bonds as a riskless asset. So now you've got European banks loading up on European government debt, and they can now use this as an asset. They'll show it on their balance sheet, and it gets counted as a riskless asset. So in essence, the ECB has created, the European Central Bank has created a near infinite purchaser of assets without announcing an asset purchase scheme.
So they don't have to call it quantitative easing.
It's QE without the QE.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see what I mean? I mean, it's, we just worked around the problem. As any individual or child would do, show me the rules, and then I will tell you within about 10 minutes how you work around them. That's exactly what they've done to remain constitutionally viable or on the right side of the law. But there is this issue of commercial interest in euro paper, commercial interest in euro paper over and above U.S. And I'm not convinced that there isn't some big money expecting to see an increase in the euro and a decline in the dollar, where your euro purchases, even though you're accepting a lower cash flow, you have another way of making money in bonds, and that is, what are your bonds denominated in? If the euro goes up, you may have made very little in terms of the income stream, but you have capital gains on the basis of your currency exposure. So when you go to liquidate it, if the currency has increased in value vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar, you're in a much better position. That's one particular issue in play that certainly leaves me with concerns about the direction of the euro and the U.S. dollar, because here's where it's particularly relevant for a gold owner. If you expect euro outperformance, then the dollar would be going down. On the other hand, take the other side of that. Draghi has promised greater accommodation, and Draghi is very close to not only the backdoor workaround for an asset purchase plan, but an outright QE. As and when he announces that, you could certainly see the dollar pull ahead. That is, the dollar go up relative to the euro. We saw that every time we announced a QE here in the United States, the dollar took it on the chin. Because the world markets understand what it means to print money. Even if we at home don't know what it means, the world markets fully appreciate the fact that you're diluting the purchasing power of your currency the more you print of it. And that's exactly what QE is. So as and when, or if, the ECB announces their asset purchase plan and outright QE, explicit QE, you could very well see the euro drop, the US dollar go higher, and gold go lower. Well, that's unfortunate in the short run for the gold owner. It's of great benefit to the US dollar owner and treasury owner. But, you know, these again are things that we have to deal with in light of what the ECB and other central bankers are telling us. Draghi suggested at Jackson Hole that more intervention was on the horizon. And as Europe is sort of losing speed and moves towards a complete economic stall, we could expect short-term euro weakness on that basis.
Well, David, you know, when you talk about the dollar rising or the dollar falling, I think it's important to restate over and over and over that we're not talking about the dollar buying more assets or real things. The euro falling or the euro rising or the dollar falling or rising, what we're talking about is relative to each other. And yet they're both are registering inflation, which means that things, real items, are costing more and more. You know, Adam Ferguson last week brought out so importantly that all governments indulge in inflation. That's what he said. He said all governments will and do indulge in inflation. So no matter what the central bank talks about, they can make us worry about deflation. You know, none of that really matters. They will indulge in inflation. And so we know that the dollar, does not buy what it did last year or the year before. Okay. And, you know, our side of the street. Okay. Let's come to this side of the Atlantic for a moment. Rates are looking like they're probably going to be going up here in the United States. How much can we take of that?
Yeah. Well, you've got two central bankers who are taking the other side of the coin. Draghi is suggesting greater intervention, perhaps euro weakness on that basis in U.S. dollar terms. And as you mentioned, you know, Adam Ferguson last week, I think would have suggested the dollar and the euro are both circling the drain, returning to their intrinsic values because you do have governments exercising the right to print and they're printing a lot. Mark Carney at the Bank of England, Janet Yellen, of course, at the Fed, they're hinting at raising rates, taking the financial community in the opposite direction. And, you know, the issue is these two banks, the Bank of England and the Fed, have already expanded their balance sheets to unprecedented levels and maybe nearing sort of their balance sheet limits. That's not to say that they can't acquire more assets and expand their balance sheets further, but it'll be with greater and greater consequence in terms of, you know, credit ratings, concerns about the currency, et cetera, et cetera. On balance, here's the question. On balance, will the liquidity created by the European Central Bank, when you net out the taper here in the United States and the end of the current QE programs, will it be enough to support equity markets here, there, frankly, everywhere? I mean, we look at the emerging markets and the developed markets, and we are all rising on a sea of liquidity. That sea of liquidity has been enhanced by the Bank of Japan, by the Bank of England, and by the U.S. Federal Reserve. And now the Bank of Japan is saying, you know, frankly, it's not working for us. We're not changing course, but it's not working. The Bank of England and the Fed are saying, we've done our part, and the economy is recovering. Of course, they're relying heavily on their own statistics, which have and do serve a political purpose. But this is, I think, the critical issue. On balance, this is the key. On balance, is there more liquidity going to be created by the ECB with an asset purchase plan? That's going to define asset markets for the next year to 18 months. If the ECB brings out the big guns and is willing to print what looks like an infinite number of dollars, then you can expect the FTSE, the DAX, the CAC, the New York Stock Exchange, the world stock markets to rise in response to more liquidity than they know what to do with. This is what some have called the liquidity theory of asset pricing. There has to be an overabundance of liquidity to drive asset prices higher. And so on balance, if there is an overabundance, you're going to see asset prices move higher. And I think gold will move in lockstep. When you look at the other side of liquidity theory of asset pricing, what you end up with is not enough liquidity. You're going to see a decline in asset prices. Let me look at that slightly differently. Gold could actually remain under pressure in a period of rising equity prices on the basis of central bank activism. It's the next trigger for the gold market is going to be a change in inflation expectations. And not a measured rate of inflation, that's irrelevant. CPI, everyone knows that's a bogus number. PCE, there's a growing number of people who would say, well, it's good enough for the Fed PhDs, but it's not good enough for the general public because it's not common sense enough. And I would tend to agree with that. So you've got the inflation numbers, which are more irrelevant than ever, and the inflation expectations, that is your expectation of inflation, my expectation of inflation, that expectation, which is going to define asset prices and would define also the next leg up for gold. But I do see a significant baton being passed from the Fed to the ECB. And that, again, plays out into how the dollar, the euro, and gold will play off of each other in the next 6 to 12 months. So do we need to listen to what Draghi is saying? Not only listen to what he's saying, but also look for fingerprints in the marketplace to see what he's actually doing.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The financial markets have been rising just based on pure, perfect knowledge that the central bankers are going to be successful. Okay. So we do have a bubble right now. Okay. It's a bubble that's being blown up. I would call it a confidence bubble. And people have an enormous amount of confidence in the fact that even if Yellen does pass the baton over to Draghi, that everything's just going to be fine.
Yeah, on the weekend, there was an interesting article in the Financial Times. The title was Central Bankers Face a Confidence Bubble. And this strikes at the heart of not only what we've discussed, but even the overconfidence that we discussed with William White from the Bank of International Settlements, where he said, you know, people expect more of us than they should. And frankly, as White said, I mean, the Bank of International Settlements is sort of the central bank for central bankers. And he's basically saying, We're not wizards. We get things more wrong than we do right. And yet the financial markets today are assuming that the financial wizards only get it right, never get it wrong, and have these sort of infinite powers. So it was again, Mohammed El-Erian in a different article, this one in the Financial Times over the weekend, he says, financial markets have been consistently rewarded for believing central banks are their best friends. At some point, those rewards have to be validated by fundamentals. And so it's basically the issue of the market getting ahead of itself. Pricing is to perfection, and we're assuming that the fundamentals will be there to back up this sort of perfect world that we hope for, and we're just looking for evidence to see if it is as we hope. That's right. This is the issue. This is the issue, just to look at El-Erian's comment. Market operators are operating on the basis of faith and belief, not on the basis of fact, and they're believing in central banks and central bankers. That belief structure has been a key assumption undergirding the growth in the 2014 equity markets.
Yeah, Dave, that same article talked about how the plaster cast around the market is this central bank intervention. In other words, we've all seen when we've built something, let's say it's plaster of Paris or whatever,
You break a leg and you have to put a cast on it.
Right.
You're hoping that there's a healing process going on inside, but you don't know what's actually happened inside until you take the cast away.
Right.
And that's exactly where we're at with the markets. This is reiterated in the Financial Times article. The question of, have we healed sufficiently? Because we haven't taken the cast off yet, but we're operating as if, you know, like an Owens, you can run a 100-yard dash and next to nothing on the basis that strength has returned to your leg and everything else. Is that the case? Let's remove the cast and see.
So, David, maybe this whole bubble, this confidence bubble, answers the question of how we're in another market bubble, even though we haven't really seen a recovery yet. I mean, let's face it, wages have not come up. Strangely enough, you know, when we've seen bubbles in the past, a lot of times you can say, well, we see where the money came from. Okay, you know, the tech stock bubble had come from earlier growth during the Reagan years. Okay, and then when the tech stock bubble broke, we saw that bubble transfer to the real estate bubble, but we could say, well, I see where that money came from, and it went through that real estate bubble. Then we had that break, and then we see the government come in and intervene. But at this point, the bubble's being grown mainly by debt, isn't it? I mean, there's really nothing productive that's growing this bubble.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we've had Alan Newman on the program a number of times, and he's asking this question. How are we in another stock market bubble when you have the average American net worth down considerably? That is, over the past decade, down over a third, and wage growth by far the weakest of any post-war recovery. And, you know, this is where he highlights the concern, saying, yeah, it has everything to do with central bank activism. It has to do with financial games that are played through share buybacks. You know, and of course, the two things that he's harped on, both in our interviews with him and when he's sort of off air, but we still keep up with his thoughts, the two alarm bells that are ringing for him in terms of markets, the stock market valuations today, cash levels in mutual funds are near record lows. And you still have the record high margin debt levels. Those two things stand out as two clear signals that the market is stretched and currently too speculative.
Well, let's look at that cash values in mutual funds, because that's something a lot of people don't necessarily watch. But a mutual fund has a certain amount of money that they can invest. And a lot of times for redemptions, that type of thing, they'll keep a few percent, maybe 5, 7, 8, 10% available in cash for redemptions. But at this point, the mutual fund industry, it's almost all invested, isn't it?
Well, and another way of looking at cash for an asset manager or for a mutual fund or what have you is it represents buying power. And to be fully invested is to be sort of an all-in bet on one direction, assuming that nothing can go wrong and that it's only growth from here. When you begin to see an increase in cash positions inside a mutual fund, there's growing concerns that maybe you need some cash. Very interesting. We began to see institutional investors come out of the high yield bond market probably 4 or 5 months ago. The general public was still piling in, but smart money was already pulling the plug and saying, I think we're going to want a little cash on the side. And when we saw the break in the high yield bond market here in the last few months, say six weeks even, what occurred was those folks who had moved money to the sideline, they had buying powder. They had dry powder, if you will, and they stepped into the fray and bought the asset class at a cheaper level. This is where, again, you're highlighting a mutual fund dynamic. If there's little cash there, it means that you have the all-in bet already in play.
And if you have margin debt at Records, you have the same thing going on. Basically,
not only an all-in bet. Yeah, it goes beyond an all-in bet because you're saying, I don't have enough money for the position, but I want even more. And so I'm going to borrow from the house, pay them 6, 7, 8% a year. And because I know, I am so sure that I'm going to see growth in excess of that 6 to 8% interest rate on the loan, that it's just a no-brainer. I want to borrow money from the house.
So this takes us back to the mid-70s, doesn't it? I mean, 73, 74, the Standard & Poor index fell almost by half.
About 45%, and then it spent a good period of the decade thereafter unable to recover. And a part of the reason it was having a hard time recovering goes back to that expected inflation. It went from low levels of expected inflation to a psychological shift. Forget the statistics. Forget the lies and the liars that tell them. We are talking about a perception in the marketplace which determined people's concerns and buying habits and consumer habits in the 1970s. And as and when the expectation changes, then inflation becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And as you saw expected inflation move from low to high levels, stock performance in real terms went from mediocre to catastrophic. And it was because inflation was cutting into the bottom line performance. Even if you had a 5% return for the year in your stock portfolio, what if you had 10% inflation? Do the math. Plus 5 minus 10 gives you negative 5 for the year. Even with a positive nominal return, inflation's eating your lunch.
So, you know, we refer back to the 1920s as a time to learn from. You know, we brought up Irving Kahn, and he remembers the 1920s. He remembers the 1930s. But in the 1920s, total margin debt as a percentage of GDP was extremely high, but I don't think it was as high as it is even now.
No, that's right. The Roaring 20s, with the blow-off phase in equities, 1929 being what everyone remembers as sort of the last and the peak before the crash, we saw margin debt as a percentage of GDP, right around 2%. And today we're at about 3%. We're at levels actually that have never been seen in the history of U.S. markets in terms of people borrowing money, leveraging their balance sheets to go buy stocks. And you have to scratch your head and ask yourself the question, is this an indication of value? Is this an indication, a period of time where you should be increasing risk because things are so sure? And I look around the world and I say, I don't know that anything's sure. I don't know what the euro looks like. I don't know that the Scottish and the Brits even stay together. There's so many things that are up in the air. The relationship between Germany and Russia, Russia and Ukraine, the United States and Ukraine, Azerbaijan. There are so many facets that, frankly, are unstable that you wonder, how is it that people are willing to, with such a cocksure attitude, go and borrow so many hundreds of billions of dollars to buy into the stock market.
Did you ever see the movie The Sting with Robert Redford and Newman? Okay, what was interesting about that movie was these guys walked into a confidence game, and you know, the main character who placed the large bet, who was being conned, he basically placed a bet on a false bit of information, and he ended up losing everything. And that was how the movie worked. It was a confidence game that went terribly wrong for the guy who had too much confidence. And, you know, you're looking right now, these share buybacks, you brought this up. Okay, volume is low in the stock market, yet we've got margin debt at a high. Well, you've got these companies taking out debt. They're going in and they're margining. They're buying back their stocks. You know, it's an amazing con game, but it's a sure bet by the way it's being played.
That's right. By the way it's being projected and advertised. Yet Newman also points out that for 2014, your share buybacks are running an annualized rate of $637 billion, which is a dead-on match for the buybacks that we saw in the last peak year, 2007. And he goes on to point out, just for frame of reference, that if you look at all of the inflows of new investor capital in the mutual fund, equity mutual funds, in a five-year period, 2002 to 2007, in aggregate, you're talking about $548 billion of buying into the stock market via equity mutual funds. And this is where the general public is stepping up to the plate. Who's stepping up to the plate now? You're talking about companies in 2014 far more interested in buying back or retiring shares than investors have been in buying them. And, you know, retail investors are very active, or were very active up until 2007. But they're not very active in the present period. My fear is that they're just beginning to be suckered back into the stock market as people say, you know, look, 2013 was a 30% up year. This is going to be a no-brainer, 15, 20% this year. Next year, another 20%. this is what happens when you bet on America. We're the comeback king. That kind of jargon, that kind of message is going to bring in the general public at exactly the wrong time. This returns us to Irving Kahn. If it's not a good value, just sit out and wait. And if you can't sit out and wait, he didn't say this, but I would, you probably are not made of the stuff that will make for a successful investor. Sometimes you have to exercise patience.
Well, and Dave, you know, you've brought out this here with us in the office that we're not in the gold business. We're not in the financial business. We're in the real money business. That's the first priority. When you're talking about waiting, I know there's a lot of listeners listening right now that are frustrated with the price in gold. They just want to see the price go up, but they don't understand necessarily that maybe that's exactly where you wait. You wait in real money. You brought out that Dow gold ratio a little bit before. Right now, with the Dow still overpriced relative to gold, waiting in cash isn't necessarily the answer because inflation, you said, would be the trigger probably when this thing comes apart.
Well, of course, there's an alternative, Kevin. You don't have to wait. You can join into the scheme of financial engineering wherein share buybacks, as we mentioned, this year running close to a $650 billion annual pace. And if you look at what has been bought back by corporations since 2009, $1.9 trillion in share buybacks have occurred. If you want to join in to the fray, by all means, move off the sidelines. Buy into the financial engineering concept. Look at what happens when you have central bank liquidity and the faith that goes with this great success story. But just keep in mind that every experiment in the past that has relied on central bank genius has worked up to a point, and then genius has failed. And is it, we have the honest admission of a William White saying, we get it more wrong than right. And I'm just trying to tell you, I just want the record to be set straight. You're putting too much faith and confidence in central bankers. It usually doesn't work the way we think it's going to work. And yet the general public would say, no. We want to join in with the high-frequency traders. We want to join in with those who are leveraging up. We want to join in with the financial engineering and couple our interests with theirs in this unstoppable machine of growth in the equity markets. I would suggest that just like Irving Kahn, there's a time to step back. There's a time to do something else. There's a time to wait for values, and there is a time to sit in real money and do nothing but wait for a dollar's asset to be bought at 50 cents. That is a position that we take, perhaps because we don't have the same faith or level of confidence in central banking prowess. And that issue of the public's perception of today's sort of masters of the universe, we remain the skeptics in large part because we look at the evidence which our central bankers are providing for their success story and realize that most of the evidence that they're providing to us is fabricated. It's fabricated for the express purpose of maintaining the charade.
You know, Dave, I've often wondered, and I've even talked to clients about what would our life be like if we knew we were going to live 500 years or 1,000 years. How would we look at things differently? How would we value things? What would I measure value in? Now, of course, I'm not talking about the things like family, that type of thing. You know, obviously, you're going to learn an awful lot if you live a longer lifetime than you do here on Earth right now. But Irving Kahn is a good example of someone who's lived a lot longer than just about anybody else. And it's strange at 108 that he's a man of patience. Isn't it amazing that he's still willing to wait?
Multiple cycles in the business context, multiple wars, world wars and conflicts, you know, multiple ideas coming into the fray in terms of monetary policy, a bias in terms of fiscal organization back in Washington. You know, you could say in terms of modern history, he's seen it all. And with that in mind, you can look at price and be motivated by price. And I think this is where distinguishing between price and value, price may be what you pay, value is what you get. We would organize finances according to a strategic plan. And developing a strategic plan for your assets sometimes has you on the sidelines, sometimes has you off the sidelines completely. And this is an era where certainly prices of the last 12 to 24 months have been impressive in the equity markets. How we got there? Tougher to have faith. Perhaps that's a fault of ours, being skeptics in terms of, you know, what was driving those prices higher. But at the end of the day, working a plan is taking time to some degree out of the equation and looking at values, allowing values to be more important in that context. A Dow gold ratio of 43 to 1 is where we began 13, 14 years ago. We've made great progress as gold, as real money, has increased purchasing power in that context very significantly. Up until 2011, you could certainly say we've given back some of our purchasing power gains from 2011 to the present. These long-term cycles are absolutely critical. And if you allow time to become like a cheese grater on your knuckles, if you allow it to irritate you, if you allow it to dig under the skin, you will begin to make decisions that diverge from a strategic plan. Time is one of those dangerous elements where if you simply cannot take the pain any longer, patience is not something that you can practice. Your priorities, your retirement schedule, that your daughter, you may have to write a check for her wedding. There are these external things which cause us to say, I've got to speed up the process. Value, the process of purchasing value is not a process that can be sped up. It cannot be sped up. It's not on your time frame. The market is not a respecter of you or anyone else. People don't really factor in to values in terms of market prices and values. Again, making the distinction between all of the other values that we prioritize even more than monetary and economic and financial issues. But having a strategic plan today does entail being on the sidelines with real money. Being on the sidelines with real money, looking on the horizon to a point where real assets, the land, the plant, the infrastructure of good quality companies all over the world, the real estate that may be right next to your house, next to your business, your ability to improve and grow your franchise if you're a business owner or an entrepreneur. There are times where strategically you want to put that money to work for you. And there's times where you just want to hold back and not get sucked into the fray. That's why I wanted to start with that idea from Irving Kinn. If the market's overpriced, an investor must be willing to wait.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.